our rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it's time for Viagra for your brain. Welcome, my friends. It's Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live, coast to coast, border to border, streaming around the planet. Folks in our chat room already on at least two continents that I know of. Greetings to you all, my friends. If you want to drop into our chat room, the number, the URL, you're on a web browser, listening from work or home. Odds are you can't get it in your car unless you've got one of those newfangled cell phones. But even then, don't do this while you're driving, my friends. Anyway, the URL, tomhartman.com. It actually is T-H-O-M and Hartman with two N's. But no matter how you spell it, it'll get you there. Tomhartman.com, and just click live chat. It'll drop you into our chat room. Actually, it first takes you to our message board, and then you click live chat there. It takes you into our chat room. And you can drop in and participate with some of the finest minds on the Internet. And some of the most interesting discussions where you hear news before it's even news. Yes, we've been discussing a few things there that won't be in the news until next week. So, anyway, you get to stick around. But, we have a pile of news here. By the way, the telephone number, if you'd like to call and be on the program today, anytime during the next 3 hours, our number 1-866, that's toll-free nationwide, 1-866-889-8894. And I would ask, have you called your member of Congress today? We're still waiting to hear for reasonable and rational explanations from some of the Democrats who voted for this screw-the-middle-class bankruptcy bill that passed. I still have not heard a rational explanation from any of them. If you've heard anything at all from your member of the United States Senate, let us know. And if you would like to contact your member of the United States Senate, the toll-free number for the United States Senate, of course, is 877. Ours is 866. These are all toll-free numbers. 877-SOB-USOB. That's right. I'm not kidding. I'm not making this up. The toll-free number for Congress, 1-877-SOB-U, the letter U, S-O-B. That will get you to the switchboard in Washington, D.C., and you can ask for, and you're a member of Congress. If you don't know who your United States senators are, you can simply ask. Every state has two of them. You have two U.S. senators, and in every district in the United States, you have one member of Congress. So you have one member of Congress and two senators, and you can simply ask who they are. Odds are the operator, certainly they can tell you who your senators are. Odds are they may even be able, probably can tell you who your member of Congress is, if you simply give them your zip code, although I haven't tried that. I'm just assuming that they must have some kind of a database like that. Plus, you can ask to be connected to the White House if you want to pass along your opinion to the White House answering machine. Well, you'll actually get a real person, but it's kind of a joke anyhow. If it's like in George Bush's Conversations with America, you know, it's Bubble Boy just doesn't hear dissenting views. And please, of course, don't think that change at the federal level is the most important change. Frankly, the most important change is at the local level. It's contacting your local newspapers, your local radio stations, your local television stations, the advertisers thereof on same, the editors of thereof on same, and absolutely contacting your local elected representatives, the members of your city council, the members of your school board, your state representatives, your state senators. Because the history of social change in the United States clearly shows change happens from the bottom up. Along those lines, we're just, you know, kind of getting into that sort of thing. Let's check into some of the news for the day. Some fascinating stuff happening in Washington, D.C. and around the country. Hillary Clinton is now doing a Bernie Sanders imitation. I'm not kidding. It's really remarkable. I think that Bernie Sanders is starting, you know, how things are contagious, how fads start people. Memes is the word in sociology, really. The idea of mnemonics, this whole new phrase that was just invented like in the last decade or so. And the idea is that a meme is a contagious thought. You know how there are contagious computer programs? We call them computer viruses. A meme is a thought virus. And so, for example, the last time that Alan Greenspan came before Congress, Bernie Sanders had his 3 minutes to speak, and he started out by saying to Greenspan,
Mr. Greenspan, I have long been concerned that you are way out of touch with the needs of the middle class and working families of our country, that you see your major function in your position as the need to represent the wealthy and large corporations. And I must tell you that your testimony today only confirms all of my suspicions. And I urge you, and I mean this seriously.
He goes on to say, I urge you to come to Vermont and see some real working people and so on. But I, rather than telling you about Bernie, which you've heard about before, and of course you'll hear him on the program tomorrow, here's Hillary Clinton. She's apparently been listening to Bernie, because yesterday Alan Greenspan was at a Senate hearing, and he said, actually, day before yesterday, and he said, it turns out we were all wrong. Sort of like, you know, what David Kaye, the weapons inspector, said about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Turns out we were all wrong. Well, first of all, with regard to the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, we weren't all wrong. The majority of Americans said, hey, we're not convinced. In fact, Hans Blix and Mohammed El-Baradei of the inspection service, the nuclear inspector El-Baradei and the chemical and gas weapons inspector Hans Blix for the United Nations, had done hundreds of inspections, pushing 1,000 inspections over about a 6 week period, randomly all over the country of Iraq. They had gone to Colin Powell and to Don Rumsfeld and said, tell us where your satellites say that there are weapons of mass destruction, and we will go there and find them. We will prove it to the world, and then you will have a justification to attack Iraq. And Rumsfeld and Colin Powell said, well, you know, we are not going to tell you. But then Rumsfeld went on Face the Nation and said, oh, we know exactly where it is. It's in this little triangle just north and east of Baghdad. And so Blix says, hey, if you'll tell Face the Nation, tell me. Oh, no, we're not going to tell you. Well, it turns out that he was lying to us. He was lying on Face the Nation. Bush was lying. Condi Rice was lying. And they knew they were lying at the time, and that's why they wouldn't tell the U.N. And so the U.N. is running around going, hey, we're looking for this stuff. We're looking for it. We're not finding it. In fact, everything we're finding, we've got 14,000 pages of documentation now demonstrating that this stuff has all been destroyed back before 1991 and in the years immediately thereafter. And Russia looked at that, and Japan looked at that, and France looked at that, and Germany looked at that. I take Japan out of the equation. Russia looked at that, Germany looked at that, France looked at that. Most of our allies looked at that and said, you know, it doesn't look to me like there's any risk here. It doesn't look to me like these guys are going to attack us. But Bush lied us into the war anyway. So Greenspan and then David Kaye comes out and says, it looks like we were all wrong, right? We weren't all wrong. Wolfowitz was wrong. He was the liar. Bush was wrong. He was the liar. Cheney was wrong. We now know these guys, not only did they intentionally lie to us about weapons of mass destruction, they intentionally lied to us about not knowing that 9/11 was being set up. Turns out, over 53 intelligence briefings out of 120, as I recall, that were given to George W. Bush between the time he became president and 9/11. In that nine-month period, over 53 of them specifically talked about al-Qaeda hijacking airplanes and crashing them into high-profile targets, including tall buildings in New York City. And they could have stopped that simply by hardening cockpit doors, as they have now since done. Simply by making it so that a terrorist could not kick in the door of a cockpit, they could have stopped that. Did they do that? No. And not only that, they lied to us about it. And you had Condi Rice going around on TV on the Meet the Press saying, oh, had we ever imagined that anybody, you know, we would have done something. We would have moved heaven and earth. Yeah, right. And when does this information come out? It comes out a month after the 2004 election, this internal CIA report. They sat on this thing for over a year and a half to keep us from knowing how much they had lied to us. Well, it turns out that this is not something that's just limited to issues of war and peace. Alan Greenspan is into this as well. Alan Greenspan comes before the United States Senate, and he says, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, You know, back when, in 2000, the year 2000, the last couple of years, the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton got the economy together in such a way, he raised taxes so that the government was on a pay-as-you-go basis. In other words, the amount of money that we were spending was also the amount of money that we were drawing in. That's how you're supposed to run your finances. It's how every business in America has to be run. It's how your household should be run. And Bill Clinton was pulling that off, and he said, and we thought, we, Greenspan saying, referring to the conservative believers in trickle-down economics and voodoo economics, we thought that if you cut the taxes for the millionaires and billionaires like Greenspan, that would cause such a boom in economic activity that there would be an increase in tax revenues, even though the tax rate had gone down, and total dollars going into the government would go up, and you would have more of a surplus and less of a deficit. Now, oddly, this had been tried before. Reagan had the same wacky idea. George Herbert Walker Bush called it voodoo economics. Reagan tried it in 81, in 82, in 83, in 80, and it didn't work. It created the hugest deficit this nation had ever seen. This year, a good chunk of the taxes that are being taken out of your paycheck this year, $160 billion nationally, whatever your share of that is going to pay the interest on the money that Ronald Reagan borrowed so that he could give so-called tax cuts to his rich buddies and his rich campaign donors, saying that that would stimulate the economy. It didn't stimulate the economy. What stimulated the economy was spending all that borrowed money. And George W. Bush is doing the exact same thing again. Sure, you give me a credit card with $1 million balance on it, I'll show you what it looks like to live large. That doesn't mean I'm prosperous. That means I'm living on debt. But it sure looks good. That's conservative economics. That's, I mean, obviously not the way that Eisenhower or Goldwater would have defined it, but the way that these guys who call themselves conservatives and Limbaugh and Hannity and all these folks who are out there pumping and promoting this stuff. And so Greenspan has the audacity on Tuesday to go before Congress and say, you know, looking back, hey, it didn't work. Obviously, it didn't work. And he says, and I quote, it turns out that we were all wrong. And now we get back to Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton, in a Bernie Sanders moment, as soon as Greenspan says that, turns out that we were all wrong, she says, just for the record, Mr. Greenspan, we were not all wrong. But many people were wrong. No, we were not all wrong. The Democrats were saying, hey, we've seen this song before. We've seen this movie before. We saw it in the Reagan administration. And Ronald Reagan had to raise taxes 6 years in a row. And then George Herbert Walker Bush had to raise taxes 3 years in a row just to avoid an economic meltdown from these kinds of economic policies. And George W. Bush is leading us into a major train wreck. Come on, Clinton. Come on, Greenspan. Tell the truth for once. It's Tom Hartman.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Lintball.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
When Irish eyes are smiling, sure it's like a morning spring in the lilt of Irish laughter. You can hear the angels sing.
And welcome back. Happy St. Patrick's Day, St. Patrick's Day weekend, all the celebrations coming up. Interesting time, interesting history there, the whole Jerry Adams, Sinn Féin, all a little more than we can get into today. But it's an extraordinary and wonderful part of the world. I've spent a lot of time in Ireland, one of my absolute favorite countries. So welcome back to the radio home of democracy. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Alexis de Tocqueville, the author of what was the best-selling book in the world from around 1836 to around 1845, when it was replaced by Harriet Beecher Stowe's book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, the best-selling book in the world, Democracy in America, by Alexis de Tocqueville. He came over here to the United States from France, spent about 6 months traveling around, wrote this book, which is still in print. It's been continuously in print since 1836. And he said, and I quote, what is the most important for democracy is not that great fortunes should not exist, but that great fortunes should not remain in the same hands. You recall back in 1836, there were very strict laws about the ability of families and corporations to aggregate huge fortunes over time. We had no landed gentry. There are no family fortunes. There are no dynasties dating from the 1830s. They all started after the 1880s when things like when the laws started changing dramatically. And now we have, of course, a new oligarchical class, basically. But anyhow, here's Alexis de Tocqueville. He's talking about what is the most important for democracy. It is not that great fortunes should not exist, but the great fortunes should not remain in the same hands. In that way, there are rich men, but they do not form a class. And he also went on to point out in that chapter, by the way, at some length, that should the day ever come when a class of rich men rose up and took over political power in America, creating an aristocracy or oligarchy, that that would be the end of democracy for all practical purposes, and America would simply have the pretense of democracy, what Oswald Spengler in his book The Decline of the West back in 1929 referred to as the rigidification of society. He called this the transition into the classical phase of society. Now, Spengler actually thought that this was a good thing. But anyway, we're getting a little more erudite than necessary here. Greenspan saying that he's all in favor of Bush's tax cuts because he thought that they were going to stimulate the economy. And now he says, it turns out that we were all wrong. And Hillary Clinton, well, we were not all wrong. The Democrats who voted against this were not wrong at all. And not just the Democrats, Greens, and even the Republicans who were concerned about that. I mean, a lot of good old fashioned Republicans saying, hey, wait a minute. This is bloody nonsense. Enough of this stuff. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Jay in Chicago on the line. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Jay, before I make my comment I called about, I just want to make sure you and your listeners are aware of the book American Dynasty.
Yeah, by Kevin Phillips.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Just disturbing as hell, not that I'm surprised by what I'm reading. But my reason for calling is sort of an odd and delicate subject with I'm very hesitant to be direct about it, but knowing your spiritual background from reading Last Days of Ancient Sunlight, I'll give it a shot. I hope you'll humor me and not just hang up and say I'm crazy. But
I do have to let you know, Jay, we've only got about 20 seconds before we've got to take a break, so if you could.
I'm under the impression that I'm the Messiah, and I'm wondering how I can get my manuscript circulated, because the paradox is if you think you're the Messiah, people say, go, you're crazy.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, Jay, in my opinion, we all are.
Well, if that was the case, we wouldn't be stuck in the hellhole we're in because of Bush. We would have already.
Well, we just haven't all realized it. You're one step ahead of the rest of us, but we all have to come to that realization.
Remember in the Celestine prophecy? Can I talk to you after the break or during the break?
No, I'm sorry, Jay. I'm not going to get into it. But you know, this was. If you want to get into Christianity, you know, Jesus said, "Be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." Here's your goal, my friend. 29 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. Even messiahs may call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
A long time ago, when the earth was green, there were more kinds of animals than you've ever seen. And they ran around free while the world was being born. And the loveliest of all was the unicorn. There were green alligators and long-necked geese. Humpback camels and...
Oh, sometimes we get the absolute strangest bumper music on this program.
The loveliest of them all was the unicorn.
I should dedicate that to my oldest daughter, Kendra, who loves unicorns, so I will do that. What a great opportunity. 26 minutes before the hour. Nearly. Another 4 seconds here. Welcome back, my friends. Alan Greenspan, in his testimony, he also suggested resurrecting... Oh, more of that language there. The notion of sealing off Social Security revenue from other uses. Now, he's starting to sound like Al Gore here. Alan Greenspan, he points out that last year, Social Security collected $150 billion more than it's paid out. And this has been going on since 1983, by the way, when under the Reagan administration, Greenspan and Daniel Patrick Moynihan and a bunch of other guys got together, men and women got together and put together the Social Security Commission and said, how are we going to save up enough money to be able to pay for when the baby boomers retire? Because there's this, you know, rabbit going through the snake coming, this bulge coming. It's going to go away, by the way, but there is this bulge coming, and we're going to have to pay for a whole bunch of retirement. And they said, well, let's save up a whole bunch of money. And that way, even though only one or two or three workers will be supporting one retiree, the wages from 10 and 12 and 15 workers over a 20 or 30 year period before that will have been stored up, put in a trust fund, acquiring interest because it'll be invested in government bonds, and we'll be able to take care of it. And that's the part of the story, of course, that Bush will never tell you. Even John Stewart won't tell you that, but it's the truth. It's real. And this is what Al Gore was in his fumble-mouthed, incompetent way trying to communicate to people during the debates with George W. Bush in the 2000 election about the Social Security lockbox. He was saying, we are setting aside hundreds of millions of dollars, which we're going to use to pay the benefits, the Social Security benefits, of retired baby boomers. And we need to stop spending this money. Even Bill Clinton was spending that money. Now, it didn't just go away. What they did was they borrowed from themselves. The federal government borrowed from itself. The general treasury would go to the Social Security Administration and say, see, hey, I noticed that you brought in $150 billion this year, more than you're spending out, and I know you're planning on saving that for the future. How about you loan it to us, and we will spend it, and we'll be able to make it look like our deficit is smaller than it is because we'll just call that income. This is accounting worthy of Ken Lay or Bernie Ebers. And as I said, it's not unique to the Bush administration, although it's been something that's being done ever since Ronald Reagan first instituted it. This is started under the Reagan administration and is still being done. And Al Gore was saying, we need to take that money in the Social Security Trust Fund and put a box around it. Put it in a lockbox, put a square around it, say, this is, you cannot use this for the general budget because this is money for people's retirement. Because if we keep spending this money or using it to make it look like our deficit isn't as bad as it is because money we're borrowing from ourselves instead of borrowing from China, if we keep doing that, then when it comes time to pay it back, we're going to have a huge tax increase to be able to pay back our Social Security money. Or, alternatively, we will default on the money to Social Security. And it need not be one of those disastrous government default things. We'll just pretend it's not there. And you'll see this huge, this massive transfer of wealth, because most of the Social Security money that was collected came from low and middle income workers. After all, this year, if you earn more than $90,000 a year, you pay no Social Security taxes at all. Up until the 1960s, 1970s, you earned more than $5,000 to $10,000 a year. You didn't pay any Social Security taxes. And so this is money that was paid in by low and middle income workers. And if we wiped that debt out, if Bush can figure out some way to finagle Social Security so that he doesn't have to pay it back, then it's going to allow for a tax cut for millionaires and billionaires. So we'll be transferring hundreds of billions of dollars from the working people to the wealthy. That's the bottom line. Not that that's not already happening, but that's the bottom line. So Greenspan says, here's his language, his exact language. We need, in effect, to make the phantom lockbox around the trust fund real. Alan Greenspan. He has occasionally lucid moments in his old age. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. John in New York on the line. Hey, John, thanks for patiently waiting. What's up?
No problem. Happy St. Paddy's Day.
Thank you, and the same to you.
Okay, I just wanted to give an announcement quick. There's an anti-war protest at the Worldwide Movement. It's going to take place on March 19th. It's going to be 316 cities in the U.S., followed by five other countries. Any issues on the table? It's not only anti-war, the way he's running this thing, it just it can't be done anymore. So
you're talking, John, about a protest in Manhattan.
No, this is worldwide on the same day.
Oh, I see.
16 cities simultaneously. Do a Google search.
Right. No, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, and in fact, I promoted it yesterday on the program. Rather,
I appreciate that. And you know, if this is the only way we're going to get things done by sitting idle and people just talking about their anger and doing nothing.
Yeah.
It's not helping us anymore.
Yeah, I agree. And this program is rebroadcast on Saturdays as well on Sirius Satellite Radio and on some radio stations. And so if you happen to be listening right now on Saturday instead of Thursday, you know, get out there. Yeah, Google the what's the best phrase to Google for this, John?
March 19th anti-war protest or movement. You'll have 21,000 hits come up.
There you go, and you can find, you know, there's several groups that will point you to the one nearest.
Yeah, outnow.org, judgebush.org, a bunch of different coalitions.
Yeah, and they'll all they're all working.
Would you believe that George Bush is the antichrist?
You know.
That's more believable, right?
Yeah, that actually, there's some credibility there. The one that used to spook me. Now this dates me, I suppose, but this was back some years ago. You know, in Revelation it talks about the beast and the whore, right? And the whore has a name that is, or the beast has a name that is 666, and the number of the name is 666, and the whore would have the mark of the beast on her, and the horn, the mark of the horn of the beast. And when Gorbachev, with that horn-like birthmark, first started hanging out with Ronald Wilson Reagan, who has six letters in each one of his three names, 666, I got to tell you, even I got a little weirded out by that. But that's about as far as it goes. I mean, that's the limits of my Christian paranoia. So, but
well,
John,
I appreciate talking with you, and thank you for the output.
Get folks out there for the march. We need to stand up and say enough.
Well, I'm going to be out there. Everybody around me is telling me, "Oh, what's it going to matter?" But you know what? It really does matter. When it comes down to it, we can't just cry about issues. We got to be about the issues.
It really does. It really does. Well said, John. Thanks for the call and thanks for mentioning it. 1-866-889-8894 telephone number. Roger in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Roger. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. You started talking about Social Security. There were two other things that got done back then, and that was the government, the WEP windfall elimination provision and the government pension offset.
Right.
So anybody who was already vested in Social Security, who became a teacher or a firefighter in about 15 states, get their Social Security reduced by two-thirds. So they get a smaller pension because they didn't get the time in the public sector teaching, and they get a smaller pension from Social Security, and the two of them together don't come up to what it would have been had I not gone and been a teacher.
Right, and there's a whole bunch of these little kind of play games with it, screw the workers situations that mostly involve federal and state employees.
Yeah, and they did the same thing that they didn't have it affect anybody over the age of 55.
And the way that they sold them was, this will be a better deal for you than Social Security. And it ain't never happened that
way.
Well,
no, but when I left driving truck in the woods and became a school teacher, I was going to get my Social Security pension and my teacher pension after 20 years of teaching.
Right.
Then they changed the law and said, oh, you're only going to get one-third of your Social Security because you haven't been paying in for the last 20 years.
Right, because you've been paying into the teacher's program.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the government pension offset is if the woman, let's say the man was a teacher, the woman worked as a secretary, and she's drawing her Social Security, that gets reduced from the widow's benefit from the public employee's retirement system.
Right, because his Social Security fund is worth less.
Well,
the bottom line, just
her Social Security dropped.
Right, I understand. Roger, let's just hyper simplify this for our listeners who may not have an understanding of, you know, the ins and outs of what happens when people become employees of various branches of government. The bottom line here is that politicians have been playing games with Social Security for a long, long time. Invariably, their sales pitch is, this will be better for you than Social Security. We'll be able to invest this in the stock market. This will, you know, quack, quack, quack. And the bottom line is people get screwed.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the bottom line.
So
when Bush or any of his friends or any of these other shills, or they issue their phony news releases, or you see these phony news reports, or you get one of these letters from the Social Security Administration, or you listen to their sales pitch while you're on hold, these highly politicized Social Security Administration, which is in and of itself a crime, in my opinion, a prosecutable crime. When you hear this stuff, just know there's a hidden agenda. That hidden agenda has to do with hundreds of billions of dollars in profit that Wall Street wants to make, and millions, if tens of millions, certainly perhaps as many as hundreds of millions of dollars that Wall Street is spending to lobby and to hand off cash to our politicians in Washington, D.C., and very often at the state level as well, to try and convince us of this.
But it's even more subversive than that. When the baby boomers start selling their stock, the stock market's going to take a dump, and they need to find some way of siphoning, forcing people to invest in the stock market to keep it from going in the dumps. Now, I would like to take a little thunder off of Alice, and that is ask all Tom Hartman listeners to be at Halverson Park at 11 o'clock on Saturday in Eureka, California.
Oh, you must be listening on KGOE.
Oh, of course.
Okay. All righty. Great.
Right.
So Roger and Alice have dueling protests? Or was she?
No, no, no.
I thought hers was
protest.
More generic. Okay. Okay, great.
It's the exact same protest. Alice great. The other day wasn't able to give you the location.
Oh, okay. And so
and all
did.
I'm saying is the location is Halverson Park at 11 o'clock, and I'm going to have a Tom Mouse for President sign.
Okay. Well, the mouse is still alive, I'll tell you that.
Good.
Roger, thanks a lot. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Raymond in Cement City, Michigan on the line. Hey, Raymond, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, I just kind of want to get to this this question regarding Social Security lockbox funds. Which I'm on the same page. I think we need to, safeguard Social Security and the funds that were collected for it. However, and this might be academic given 3 or 4 years of Bush, but assuming you don't have a budget deficit and you don't have a lot of bonds outstanding, what do you do with all that cash that you're accumulating for this retirement in the Social Security fund? Right now it's going into these bonds. But if you have no, if the government doesn't need to borrow the money, where do you put the money? And if you pull it out of the economy, doesn't that bring the economy down? It's got to circulate in the economy.
Right, Raymond, first of all, broadly, no offense, but your question is sort of like, if I had a stairway from my bedroom to the moon, would I be able to drill for water on the moon? The reality is, with a $7 trillion debt, it's not going to be in your lifetime or mine that our federal government is ever going to stop issuing treasury bills or bonds.
Well, that's true.
Okay, number one. So,
I agree with
so that. That will always be available. Number two, if by some miracle we did pay off the entire federal national debt and the government was no longer in debt and no longer had to issue bonds or treasury bills, then there's no shortage of other governments that do, and there's no shortage of corporations that do, and many of them, you look at Moody's AAA rated, many of them are pretty much – you know, you can't say absolutely as safe as U.S. government bonds, because U.S. government bonds have never been defaulted on, but many of them have never been defaulted on. They're very, very solid. So, you know, there is no shortage of investments, of potential investments, or for that matter, there are money market funds. For that matter, I personally don't object to Social Security investing a small portion of Social Security in an appropriate basket of stocks, mutual funds, whatever. I mean, it's fine with me if they figure out a way to put a little bit of risk and a little bit more income into the Social Security Trust Fund. But the reality is that the Social Security Trust Fund, and this is what most people fail to get, the Social Security Trust Fund is a temporary thing. From the time when Social Security was first created back around 1935, 1936, They had to borrow money to start paying people who were getting the initial benefits, because there were no, so for the first couple of years they borrowed money. And then they were, the taxes were coming in and it was paying out. And from that point until 1983, basically Social Security funded itself. Every year the amount of money that came in was the amount of money that went out. And they looked out into the future, because these guys, these actuarials, they're always doing these 70-year projections. They looked out into the future and they said, there was this explosion of births between 1946 and 1954-55, the baby boomers. And there's this explosion of births when all our GIs came home from World War II. And those people are all going to retire, around 2020, 2030, 2040, in that realm. And at that point in time, if the demographic trends continue with regard to births in the United States, we're not going to have enough, on a pay-as-you-go basis, we're not going to have enough money without really jacking up taxes a whole lot for Social Security to pay these folks. So let's start saving money right now. And so they created the Social Security Trust Fund in 1983 out of the Moynihan Greenspan Commission. And it is a And, you know, and Bush shows this, and Frist, and all these you know, liars in Washington, D.C., they show these charts that show that suddenly after 2012 or 2016, depending on whose numbers you're using, the government is going to go into the red. It's going to start spending money it's not receiving. It's supposed to do that. That's the trust fund. That's right. That's when we start paying out the trust fund that we have accumulated since 1983. Now, on the other side of this, when you get around to 2080 or 2070, 2080, we're back to the point where the Social Security system can pay for itself.
But, Tom, I mean, I agree. You're going beyond my point that I wanted to get understood here, and that is that as you said, there are some other investments you can put it in to put it into circulation. Well, if you can balance the budget currently and then have this excess for a few years, are there some other investments besides the 2 or 3%, like in corporate bonds or municipal bonds, that would help us?
I think there are. Raymond, we're out of time, but I think there are. And even if there aren't, I mean, 1 or 2%, it's safe. 10 minutes before the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, Danny boy, the pipes are calling.
And happy St. Patty's Day.
From glen to glen and down the mountainside.
And 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And just a reminder, the toll-free number for Congress, should you want to call your elected representatives and give them a piece of your mind about anything, the bankruptcy legislation, I'm still fried about that. I still want to hear from these Democratic senators. 1-877-SOB-USOB, that's the toll-free number for Congress. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, Jay in Atlanta on the line. Hey, Jay, welcome to the program.
Hey, I wanted you to address a Chomsky quote for me, but I also needed to let that previous caller know that one time George Bush in jest said that the Internet was named after me, www, and it turns out in Hebrew, W is represented by 6.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Funny coincidence, eh?
Yeah. No, but maybe not. So, coincidence or conspiracy?
Exactly. I know you know that there are no such things, as they say, but the Chomsky quote here, he says, small changes you can propose, but to be realistic, substantial change, which will really alter the large-scale direction of things and overcome major problems, will require profound democratization of the society and economic system. I just got to wonder, well, how the hell are we going to make that happen?
Well, what Chomsky is missing in that quote, and I know that he knows it and he speaks of it often, but what is missing from that quote is that rather than talking about specific issues and items in a vacuum, we all must put them in the context of a larger picture. We must have a clear understanding of what democracy in a constitutionally limited republic means, that it means the will of the people, that it doesn't mean that corporations have equal rights with humans. It doesn't mean that multinational corporations should be defining our trade policies, no matter what it does to workers in the middle class.
Well, I've read the book When Corporations Rule the World and countless others of that vein. And what you just said, people like your base of listeners, we already know that, but
we have to share it with others. I mean, there was a time, Jay, in America when there was a relatively small number of people who knew that slavery was wrong or knew that women should be allowed to vote, and they spread the word, and that's how you get it done. And that's what we have to do. And you know, just like there was a relatively small number of people in the United States who thought that you know, conservative policies were a great thing, or that, you know, abortion should be illegal. And they're actually getting traction because they're out there knocking on doors and spreading the word. That's what we have to do. The contagious stuff that we have to spread is not so much the specific policy proposals. Those are the vehicles for it. We have to spread the idea, the concept. As George Washington said, I would hope to see that America shall ever become more liberal. That's the direction. You know, we want to see a country that works for everyone. A country
that did a very good job.
A world at peace. Thank you. Yeah, and that's what we've got to do. Jay, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. We need to be spreading the meme, spreading the idea, spreading the vision, holding the vision. We in the vast, radical, middle conspiracy.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to West Virginia, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org, Live 365's American FM. Remarkable. You can drop into our chat room where we have folks from at least two, possibly three continents hanging out right at the moment. Go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. It'll get you in there. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number if you'd like to call in and be on the program. In our last hour, it was interesting. We had a few callers who were speculating about the mark of the beast. Nothing that I instigated. I mean, this is, it must be the day. Maybe it's because it's the St. Patty's Day day and weekend here. Although somehow I doubt it. It's a very Catholic country, but beyond that, I've never thought of it. In any case, let's take it to the next step. Sometimes it is, of course, the second hour of our program in that day of the week when we go beyond what we know, into those things that we don't know we know, and we don't even know that we don't know them, and you don't know that you know that you, although you do know that you don't know it, but and you may know that you don't know what it is, but you do know that you may need to know it. Maybe you need to know it a whole lot, or maybe even what you do know is not right. Could
you
be.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is it possible? Shoppers in Washington State are now paying for their purchases with their eyeballs. Check that out. Now, it's a little bit of a, of course, I got your attention now. Andrew Goss is one of the nation's foremost experts on the history of the U.S. monetary system, the author of two books, The Secret World of Money and Uncle Sam Cooks the Books, as well as the editor of The World of Money Investment Newsletter. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom.
First of all, do you have a website where our listeners can learn more about you and what you do?
I do, www.usgoldcoins.com.
usgoldcoins.com. So presumably you sell gold and...
I buy and sell American gold coins. That's my
cool
gig.
Well, it's a good investment right now as the Bush administration continues to drive the value of our dollar into the toilet.
Yeah, through dilution. They just keep diluting the dollar.
Yep, but that's...
Crunch all you want, we'll make more.
There you go. But that's another topic, perhaps for another time, and it's not quite as odd as this one here. You have some information about what's going on with the U.S. Thriftway chain, a store in Washington State, the pay-by-touch system that is in place, where, rather than my putting words into your mouth, why don't you just tell our listeners, what's the deal here? We have a new payment system.
Indeed. And in one of our quarterly newsletters a year and a half ago, I wrote a piece entitled Credit Cards and Passwords Are Passé. And it's my contention. Remember, I'm also a paranoid in addition to being a numismatist. I believe that the identity theft epidemic in this country will be solved by using biometric information instead of carrying cards.
And biometric information mean things like fingerprints, iris scans, DNA checks.
DNA check, that's a good one. But voice print.
Yeah.
DNA voice check, print. That would. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that one.
Yeah, you just put a little
take
bit
a little
of
blood.
Put a little spit on it.
Yeah.
Give them a hair. Pull a hair out of your head. Give them a hair.
Well, yeah. That type of information, as many Americans know, is unique to individuals, and so then it will be the answer to this epidemic problem that is facing the country, this terrible, terrible
identity
theft.
Well, now, you could construct a nice little conspiracy theory here, Andrew
Goss. I
got one
already, yeah.
Where the companies that are in the business of buying and selling information about us somehow accidentally release, say, 100 million records, including members of Congress, where the tapes get lost, files get hacked, and identity theft is suddenly rampant, including members of Congress. My Senator Pat Leahy was among the names and Social Security numbers that was most recently hacked into. He's now got a burr under his tail about it.
Oh, yeah.
And that they did this because really what they would like to do is move us to a cashless society where they – and now this is where we could digress from the old – John Stormer, none dare call it treason, John Birch, traditional conservative paranoid conspiracy theory, they being the government big brother, to the Abby Hoffman left wing, the corporations are out to get you conspiracy theory of, no, it's not government that you have to worry about, it's corporations taking over government or using the power of government, you know, the power of the gun, the legal gun. But in any case, one or the other, take your pick, that they then say, well, we're going to make it easy for you. It's impossible to steal your eyeball. It's impossible to steal your thumbprint. It's impossible to steal your DNA. So we're going to make it so that when you pay for a transaction, you do it by putting your thumbprint on something. The same way now that the INS is doing it with aliens coming into the United States. Or we're going to do an iris scan, as many large corporations, particularly in the defense industry, are doing now to verify identity. These systems are not science fiction. This isn't Tom Cruise movie stuff. And that the ultimate goal would be to have total control over us. They would know absolutely where we are at all times, what we're doing, who we're talking to, how we're speaking. If it was based on voice prints, it would be very to tap a phone. It wouldn't even matter. You know, all the whole song and dance that you normally have to go through with a phone tap to figure out who's speaking. You just plug it into the computer and comes right back. Hey, that's Andrew Goss. Right.
That's right. Well, the big fear, from my perspective, I mean, I appreciate all the privacy concerns and everybody that's worried about what government cares what you're saying on the phone. That's not, to me, that's not the important issue. The overriding issue here is the last remaining check and balance on the banking system. What that is, Tom, is our ability to go into the bank, any bank, and say, okay, you say I have $1,000 on deposit in this bank, great, put it on the counter.
Give it to me.
Give it to me.
Yeah.
And it's the only thing that keeps them honest. So I guess I'm in the Abby Hoffman group because I believe that given the chance, banks would have zero reserves.
Well,
they didn't have to worry that somebody might show up tomorrow to ask for their money. They wouldn't keep any money.
Well, they certainly at this moment don't have enough reserves to pay out anything close to
correct.
I mean, if there's a run
least,
on the banks.
But at least they have some.
Yeah.
Now, if you remove that last check and balance, our ability to go to the bank and get the cash, then they don't have to have any.
So how do the biometrics figure into this? I mean, here we have a store.
Well, they eliminate cash.
Well, yeah. Sort of. I mean, you've got this store, a U.S. Thriftway chain in Washington State, where you can pay for your groceries by putting your thumbprint down.
Correct.
And they built this database of people's thumbprints. And now, you know, in fact, here this notice is, you had suggested, a pizza chain in Missouri now shares its customer database with state law enforcement agencies. So somebody with an unpaid ticket or outstanding warrant calls to place an order. Authorities immediately see the address. The customer opens his door expecting a 14-inch pepperoni and instead gets a SWAT team. And the pizza chain gets a cash reward. So this is happening right now.
That's right. And
this is not some paranoid fantasy. This is happening right now.
That's right.
Now, here's
the customer for this information is the federal government.
Right. Now here's where I just, you know, your suggestion that the ultimate protection against total bank fraud is that you can go. Why couldn't you simply go to a bank and say, I want my $1,000 here, scan my eyeball?
Well, because the necessity for cash will be completely eliminated, which is really what we're trying to do. The idea that you need cash at all will then be looked upon as, well, what are you trying to hide? What are you trying to avoid? why don't you just touch the pad?
Well, there
everybody
is.
Everybody will have one. Why don't you just touch the pad?
Well, and that rationale is already in use, by the way, Andrew Goss. And your website, again, was usgoldcoins.com,
correct?
.com, right.
Or for a free sample of the newsletter, call the 800 number.
Okay, which is?
800-468-2646. Mention Tom Hartman and get a few free copies of the World of Money Investment Newsletter.
Cool. And I didn't know that was coming. That's great. Thank you. In any case, they have already put that out. I mean, that was part of the rationale back 8, 10, 12 years ago when they passed a law saying that if you take more than $10,000 out of the bank or deposit more than $10,000 into the bank, that they're automatically the bank has to notify the federal government about it because it might be drug money.
Now it's $3,000, incidentally.
Yeah, I know. It went down to $5,000, and now it's – I didn't know it went down to $3,000. I knew it had gone down to
$5,000. Well, it is here in New York City.
I see. So that's a local thing. But in any case, they have already used that. They've said, you know, we understand that you might need $50 for walking around money, or you might want to go to a yard sale and buy, a used coffee table for $35. But what do you need $10,000 for? And
right.
So I'd say we're already there, Andrew.
Well, indeed, except now we've gone a little further, and the presence of cash is evidence that a crime has been committed. So, judicial notice has been given to this.
The presence of cash is not evidence of a crime being committed, it falls into the Fourth Amendment category, though, of probable cause. Which is just as bad for all practical purposes. But let's be precise here.
Yeah, the police officer can proceed as though he has evidence that a crime has been committed.
That's right. The probable cause threshold has been tripped.
Right. So now, just having cash means that everything else is subject to scrutiny because now the foot is in the door, so to speak.
Right.
So the further criminalization of cash will just lead us to that ultimate end, which is, what do you need it at all for? Again, you must have something to hide, or there must be a reason, a motive why you're not willing to allow for the electronic transfer of money.
And now, in the largest of paranoid fantasies here, Andrew, we're talking, by the way, with Andrew Goss, one of the nation's foremost experts on the history of the U.S. monetary system, author of two books, The Secret World of Money, Uncle Sam Cooks the Books, as well as the World of Money Investment Newsletter. And we've only got about a minute left. What's in it for government in all this? Why would they do this?
Well, from government's perspective,
or corporations,
from a corporate perspective, it's all about the money. They capture two things. They capture the float and they capture the information. The float being the most important thing. 100% of your money is electronically deposited all the time. And so then it's subject to use by that bank when you're not using it.
Right.
And electronically, boom, it can be put right back.
Which they're already doing, by the way. I mean, this Indeed. Whole thing, your banks now say, okay, it takes 3 days to clear a check. It doesn't take 3 days. It takes a few hours. But they want those 3 days because they're going to make money on that float.
Yeah, it's an enormous amount of money. And the underground economy was estimated at $500 billion by the L.A. Times. The IRS estimates that it could reap a tax windfall in excess of $100 billion if cash was forced into the electronic system so that they could appropriately tax individuals.
So from the federal government's point of view, it's like we can get a little more money. But they've got a million ways to do that. But from a corporate point of view, it's absolute control over us
over
and our finances, and over the monetary. Mind-boggling. Andrew Goss, thank you so much for being with us. One more time, real quickly, give us your website and your toll-free number.
It's 800-468-2646, 800-468-2646.
And the U.S. coins?
U.S. gold coins.
USgoldcoins.com. Thank you, Andrew. 20 minutes past the hour with Tom Hartman.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that...
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Now you love me as a loser, but now you're worried that I just might win. You know the way to stop me, but you don't have the discipline.
Oh, yes. No, it's not. That's not George W. speaking. It's really not. It's Leonard Cohen. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Richard Miller with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with our daily report from Washington, D.C. Hey, Richard, we don't hear from you often.
Well, how you doing, Tom?
Great.
In part because I've just returned from Camp Fallujah in Iraq, where I believe we spoke a couple of days ago.
Yes, we talked with you live in Iraq last week, as I recall. What did you learn? What happened? And what's going on in Washington? And all that kind of stuff.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm going to have to defer on the Washington question. I'm much better on the news from Camp Fallujah.
Okay, well, let's go for it.
There's not a heck of a lot about Washington one learns in Fallujah. But a lot about Fallujah one learns in Fallujah.
Yeah.
I guess there's a lot, Tom. I suppose one of the things I've walked away with from the experience is the notion that the insurgency is a misnomer. There are real people who are killing others by the hundreds there. But it's an amazingly disorganized and fairly low-tech band of a mix of some criminals, some Baathists, some jihadis, some foreigners. And it's amazing how erratic it is. It's not an organized military force.
To what extent, Richard, are the insurgents, let's say, you know, just, we'll use that word generically, as you said, it's not a cohesive bunch, but the people shooting at us, let's say.
Yes.
To what extent are they... How to put this? I try to put myself in the place of if Canada occupied the United States to save us from George W. Bush because they were afraid that he was going to use our nuclear weapons against Russia and Canada, now that Canada has denied us access to their airspace. And so they were trying to, you know, save us from a madman in charge of our country.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went in and they changed our constitution and they changed our laws and they made it illegal for us to have trade unions, as we have done in Iraq. I might be inclined, if I had a gun, to get out on the streets and start shooting at Canadians. I mean, you know, at least I could understand it. I'm in my own personal personality. Well, it's hard to say what I would do if I was pushed far enough, but, you know, I can get that. And so... I've always assumed that at least some percentage, I mean, if we have killed 100,000 innocent civilians in Iraq, that means that there's got to be, the average Iraqi family probably has 20 or 30 members, you know, an extended family, grandparents, right, uncles, aunts, cousins, you know, close, 20 to 30 close members. So that means that there's probably 2 or 3 million people who are really, you know, filled with rage at us because their innocents have been killed. And many of those people, it seems to me, would just pick up a gun and say, I'm going to go kill an American for revenge. To what extent is that going on? To what extent is this insurgency either the natural resistance to occupation or the rage at the incompetence with which we have fought this war up to this point and killed so many civilians in the process?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, Tom, frankly.
Is it a lot bit of both?
Well, I would add one other thing.
Yeah.
The insurgency, remember, is not coming from the 60% Shia or the 20% Kurd. It's coming from the Sunni.
Exclusively.
And the Sunni population, remember, has essentially ruled the other 80% of the country now for some 3 or 4 decades.
Yeah. Although on the other side, the Sunni cities were the major cities, and those were the places that we bombed most heavily, and that's where there was the most collateral damage, where we killed the most civilians. You know, Baghdad,
well, right.
Fallujah.
It becomes a vicious circle because the Ba'ath Party and the Ba'ath Party infrastructure, both military and political, were largely drawn from Sunni population.
Right.
Which means that so much of the military violence is directed against the Sunni triangle.
We got about 5 or 10 seconds left, Richard. What would you suggest we do or think about this? How should we be reacting?
We've got to turn over the country to the people who live there and bail as quickly as we can.
Okay, that's what I've been saying all along, is that we, or not all along, but certainly for the last few months, is that we have become more of an irritant than a help.
That's correct, and I'd say that's correct.
Yeah, okay, great. Richard Miller with the Talk Radio News Service, just back from Iraq. Richard, thanks so much for your report today. I truly appreciate it. 29 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the real free speech zone. .org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Tell me you love Fox Real Street.
Speaking of making over, we rather made over Vietnam, you'll recall, some years ago. And the Vietnamese came forward and said to the United States, you dumped 21 million gallons of Agent Orange on our nation, an herbicide, a defoliant. The purpose of this, of course, was to kill every living green thing, which wiped out the crops. And there's a twofold purpose. One, the overt purpose, the publicly declared purpose at the time, was to prevent the Viet Cong from having hiding places. Can't hide in the jungle if there's no jungle. But the other purpose for which Agent Orange was extensively used, which we learned later when we were able to read Pentagon reports, you know, 10, 15 years after the fact, was to create mass starvation in those areas that we considered insurgent areas so that people would leave as refugees and we could, you know, more easily control them or simply to kill them off. And it worked. So the little side effect of this was that the Agent Orange was contaminated by a class of chemicals known as dioxins. And dioxin, for example, being the chemical that many in the intelligence services are alleging Vlad Putin or his friends, the former KGB head who now heads Russia, put into a meal that was eaten by Mr. Yushchenko, the now the Prime Minister of the Ukraine. Remember, you recall, you know, this handsome-looking guy, and all of a sudden he's got this incredibly disfigured face. Well, there's a lot of Vietnamese who have very disfigured faces and bodies, and there's been this explosion in birth defects, and one of the horrible things about dioxin contamination is that it not only contaminates the body of the person that it's in, but that it also damages DNA. So it creates multi-generational consequences. By damaging DNA, it causes not just birth defects, but the children who have the birth defects are carrying damaged chromosomes, which they will pass on forever. And this is true of many, many compounds which are toxic to deoxyribonucleic acid, to DNA, or RNA, or both. And so dioxin is a serious chemical, serious problem. And 4 million Vietnamese put together a class action lawsuit, something that our federal government, our Senate, in its infinite, and the House of Representatives, in their infinite wisdom, with the signature of George W. Bush just week before last, made it much more difficult for you and me to do. In fact, made it illegal and impossible for us to do it in state courts, but made it possible in federal courts. Anyhow, 4 million Vietnamese came before the United States to a federal court and said that the U.S. chemical companies that made this stuff, that specifically being there was about a dozen companies, the largest ones were Monsanto and Dow Chemical, that they should pay some sort of reparation. Because at the time, according to these Vietnamese victims, at the time, these companies knew that their product was contaminated with dioxin and could have predicted that this would be the consequence. And so a federal judge, Jack B. Weinstein, U.S. District Judge Jack B. Weinstein, disagreed with the charges. First of all, he said that Agent Orange should not be considered a poison banned under international rules of war, even though it had the effect of killing people. He says it wasn't like, you know, the poison gas that was used against the Kurds. Instead, it was an herbicide, and so it's not considered a poison banned under the international rules of war, number one. So it wasn't a war crime. And number two, the other argument that was made by the lawyers for Monsanto and Dow and these other companies is that international law generally exempts corporations, as opposed to individuals, from liability for alleged war crimes. Do you get this? These corporations who want to say, we're a person, If a community doesn't want to have a Walmart in it, they can't stop us because that's discrimination under the 14th Amendment, which says that you can't discriminate against a person. All persons have equal protection under the law. You can't have one set of laws for white people and one set of laws for black people. Similarly, you can't have one set of laws for human persons and another set of laws for corporate persons. This was a precedent that was established in 1936 by J.C. Penney when they sued the state of Florida. Or you have Dow Chemical Company saying that under the Fourth Amendment, they have the right of privacy. And so when the EPA shows up, they can no longer do surprise inspections. They have to have probable cause and a warrant. They have to have some evidence that a crime was committed. Or if it's going to be a random inspection, it has to be at the time and choosing of Dow Chemical. And they took that to the Supreme Court and they won because they claimed, hey, we're a person. Nike argued last year before the Supreme Court that as a person, they should have the First Amendment right to lie to us. And they were supported in that by the parent companies of all the major networks, Gannett, the big news chain, the New York Times Corporation, the Washington Post Corporation. The corporation should have the right to lie. So here you have this huge movement across the United States. As I am speaking to you, I guarantee you, somewhere in the United States, there is a workshop being held by one of the many organizations, the Federalist Society and others, who are promoting this idea of corporate personhood, telling corporate lawyers how they can use their personhood rights, their Bill of Rights rights, to assert authority or control over local communities, over government, over the will of the people, and over individuals. And in fact, here we find that the Bush Department, Department of Justice, which at the time was Mr. Ashcroft, had supported this from ABC News, by the way, I'm reading this report, had supported the chemical companies in court, saying a ruling against the firms could cripple the president's power to direct the military. Now, we have 10,000 war veterans from Vietnam who are suffering the effects of Agent Orange. We're giving them some compensation. Not anywhere near enough, in my opinion. But the Vietnamese were telling them, take a hike, guys. You don't vote. And you don't buy these corporations' products. This is a tragedy. Absolute tragedy. 1-866-889-8894. What we really must do in the United States is we really must realize once again, you and I are the source of power in the United States. The Constitution doesn't start out, we the oligarchs, we the aristocracy, we the rich people, we the corporations. That's not how it starts out. The preamble to the United States says, we the people of the United States do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. You know, with a bunch of language in the middle there. And until we start getting active and taking back this country, we're going to continue to see these sorts of outrageous things that have their roots in the notion that it's entirely reasonable and appropriate, as the conservatives will tell you over and over and over again, usually in code, but they will tell you their belief that it's entirely reasonable and appropriate that there be a ruling class, that class be dominated by large multinational corporations, that if their behavior harms or screws the average American worker, tough luck, sorry, that's economics 101, and that's simply the way it is. And if people get poisoned or people die, we have to examine the cost-benefit ratio and determine whether or not it's going to harm corporate profits so much that we should simply say, hey, that's life. And I think it's time for us to stand up and say, no, I'm sorry, we would like our nation back. Thank you very much. We would like it back now. And when we hear the Democratic senators, at least, and I realize I'm holding the Democrats to a higher standard than Republicans. I've given up on the Republicans. They have completely sold out. to the corporations. They are the original Darth Vader story. They have completely gone over to the dark side. Maybe Olympia Snow and George Voinovich, not entirely. Maybe Lincoln Chafee, not entirely. But I'm sorry, they're in the party. And I am not speaking as a Democrat. I'm not a Democrat. And I have a lot of problems with the Democratic Party. But I think it's particularly important that we hold the Democratic Party's feet to the fire and the members of that party and hold them accountable, because right now they're the only alternative we have to the Republicans at a federal level and in most cases at a local level. Yes, there should be stronger Green parties. Yes, we should be. Every single one of us should be engaging with the Green Party, getting active with the Green Party, or the Progressive Party here in Vermont is the stronger party. We need to be doing, you know, grassroots organizing, nonpartisan issues, all those kinds of things. And we sit around all day and complain about the Democratic Party. Take it over. Do what the Reichwingers did with the Republican Party starting in the 1970s. Take it over. There's not a sign on the front door of the Democratic Party that says millionaires only need apply. Anybody can volunteer. Anybody can participate. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number if you'd like to phone in. Tim in Illinois on the line. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for the minimum daily requirement of sanity.
There you go. What's up?
Well, this goes along with what you were just saying. It ties right in. It's something completely different. A surprise mini backbone award for four Republicans in the Senate. On Tuesday, there was a Bush budget amendment in the Senate. This was a budget, an amendment sponsored by Nelson in Florida and co-sponsored by Hillary Clinton. It was under the radar, apparently. Anyway, the amendment was that Congress should reject any Social Security plan that requires deep benefit cuts or a massive increase in debt. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The amendment was rejected 50 to 50.
Well, that's interesting.
How about that for under the radar?
So you
all had the Dems, now this is what gets more interesting, all the Dems and the Independents voted for. And four Republicans joined them.
Wow. And who were those Republicans, please?
Well, the first two are no surprise. They get the mini backbone, Susan Collins and Olympia Snow.
Right, from Maine.
Yeah. And then, this is a little surprise, Lindsey Graham and Arlen Specter.
Yeah, Lindsey Graham and Arlen Specter have been increasingly, and Lindsey Graham, you know, just saying his name leaves a bad taste in my mouth because of his activities during the Clinton administration.
Absolutely.
During the Clinton impeachment. He was the most self-righteous, pathetically self-righteous, and outspoken, one of the most outspoken members of the Senate about how this, you know, Bill Clinton getting a BJ in the White House was something that was going to bring down the Republic, and he's noticeably silent. And how Whitewater, actually, he was going on and on about how Whitewater was a criminal act that stained the presidency. The fact that Bill Clinton lost $30,000 in a land deal 30 years earlier. And he's been noticeably silent about Dick Cheney's, you know, monthly paycheck from Halliburton. But nonetheless, I'm hearing Lindsey Graham. There's a number of Republicans who are starting to speak up a little bit, shall we
What's
say.
What's amazing is that you look at this amendment. If only one more Republican senator would have had a spine, this would have passed.
Yeah, which is probably why Bill Frist was running around like crazy at the last minute.
I also wanted to make a comment about the word insurgency. I think it's a politically charged word because very contrived use by the government and the news media, because an insurgency is a movement against a government. Forces who oppose an occupation by a foreign army are a resistance.
Yeah.
I was delighted to see recently that Amy Goodman, who I really admire, she's a wonderful, brave journalist, she stopped using the word insurgents exclusively and replaces it, at least occasionally, with, quote, members of the resistance.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, this is journalism. You got to say things.
I agree, and
if it was
all that simple and all that black and white, it would be very easy to do that. I think the point that Richard Miller of the Talk Radio News Service, who had just come back from there, made is that it's just not that simple. Certainly, there are many Iraqis perhaps even the majority, obviously nobody's doing a census, who are local people saying, hey, get out of our country. And then there is the civil war that is going on under the radar, but very much going on between the Sunnis and the Shia and the Kurds, declared by the Sunnis, and the Shias and the Kurds trying to ignore it. And then you've got further complicating that, the fact that Al-Qaeda and frankly now I think is probably one of the least of the dangerous terrorist groups, but you've got a bunch of different radical Islamic groups, let's call them, who are sending people into Iran or into Iraq right now simply to get their military training. I mean, they used to go to Afghanistan and go through Osama's camps. Now they say, go spend 3 months in Iraq and learn how to use an AK-47. And so it is more complex than that. Things are always more complicated than they seem. And to simply use a single word to broad brush them, whether it's to broad brush them in a way that minimizes them or maximizes them, I think is a mistake, Tim.
Final thought. I hope 877-SOB-USOB generates an avalanche of calls to Congress.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot, Tim. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. 10 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program, the radio home of democracy. You are in the no boring zone.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Lintball.
To tell you.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I'd like to take you to the ceremony. That is, if I remember the way. You see, Jack and Jill, they're going to join their misery.
And welcome back. Our program brought to you by DemocraticMatch.com and Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com, 1-800-511-MACS, 1-800-511-MAX for smalldog.com. Support our sponsors, please. DemocraticMatch.com, of course, right there on the Internet. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Mike in Denver, Colorado on the line. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller.
Great. Welcome.
And I was watching the NBC Nightly News last night because just try to see what they have to say on there.
Oh, with Brian Williams, the guy who says that part of his job responsibility and duty as an American is to listen to Rush Limbaugh every day.
That would be the one.
Yep, okay.
So they had a story on last night about GM's profits being about half of what they had projected previously.
General Motors. Yes. And in fact, I mentioned yesterday, I think I opened the show yesterday with an email from a fellow who said that this is the beginning of the next recession.
You know, I was thinking about it today, and it dawned on me that this is kind of the big business agenda coming back to bite itself in the rear. Because they showed the breakdown of where the sales figures had fallen, like Chevy was down 25%, Pontiac was down 25%, but Cadillac's only down 3%.
Right. Yeah, this is what the Wall Street Journal did an excellent series on this right around Christmas time, and they called it the Walmart Tiffany syndrome. And basically what it is that in terms of retail sales, there are two sectors that are up. Those people who sell to those companies that sell to people with an income under $20,000 a year, more or less, basically the working poor, and those who sell to people with an income over $250,000 to $300,000 a year, that is the wealthy to the incredibly wealthy. And the companies like Sears in the middle, for example, those companies that sell to basically the middle class, people making 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, even, you know, a family, 100, 120 in a lot of communities, it's not a lot of money if you're trying to live like in San Diego, for example. Those stores are not making it because the middle class is vanishing.
Right.
And it sounds like what you're saying is the General Motors sales figures reflected that. That's fascinating. I hadn't seen a breakdown of the sales figures, but I did see the story about GM saying that they not only were they reporting a loss, but they were also revising their future figures.
Oh yeah.
And this is a canary in the coal mine here. One of many.
The CEO couldn't figure out why their numbers were down, but it was pretty clear to me when I saw them.
Yeah, it's called common sense.
Absolutely.
Well done, Mike. Thanks a lot for listening to us there in Denver. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Oh, my. Well, telling the truth that the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know about. Thank you very much. We don't really want people knowing outside. This is the Tom Hartman radio program. That's me.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you in the middle of the last radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations. The place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or even the right-wingers over at the Democratic Leadership Council. On March 1st, the Bank of America announced, this is David Sirota put this thing together. Very, very interesting take on this. On March 1st, the Bank of America announced it had lost personal financial data on more than a million people. Remember this? The Bank of America, we just said, it's gone. We don't know where it went. It's just gone. A million people. Yeah, some of them United States senators lost. 2 days later, Senator Bill Nelson of Florida, the bankruptcy law is now working its way through Congress, right? Bank of America loses a million financial records, so a million people now are vulnerable to identity theft that could wipe them out. Because, you know, somebody steals your identity, and not only do they get to spend all your money, in many cases they can spend it in ways you can't recover it. For example, if they get into your checking account, you know, if they spend your credit card money, sometimes you can end up not having to pay for that. But if they get into your checking account and just take your money, it's gone. For example. And, of course, to get your good name and your good credit back, you have to hire lawyers. It can be very expensive, very, very time-consuming. And it is enough every year to throw thousands, maybe perhaps tens of thousands of people into bankruptcy. And it's a growing problem. So Bill Nelson of Florida says, let's amend this bankruptcy law so that if somebody has to declare bankruptcy because a bank screwed up and gave their personal information out to an identity thief, and the identity theft was the result, you know, the result of the identity theft was that they had to declare bankruptcy, then in that case, they can actually go ahead and declare Chapter 7 bankruptcy rather than being forced into Chapter 13 reorganization where they have to pay off the debt for the rest of their lives, which is what the Senate just voted to do for everybody under, you know, pretty much every circumstance, unless you're just absolutely dirt poor poverty below, I mean, way below food stamp level. And the Senate took a vote on this, amendment by Bill Nelson, which makes perfect sense, you know. Senate took a vote on it and they said, the Republicans who control the Senate, they said, nah, we don't think so. If somebody gets screwed because the bank gave out their information, even illegally, even by accident, even by the result of negligence, their computers got hacked, whatever. If the bank gives out their information, and as a result of that, they end up in such terrible, dire financial straits that the only way they can dig out of that hole is to start all over again with Chapter 7 bankruptcy, tough. So now, your bank can be responsible for losing your personal information, and they can use this situation to milk you for more money. to quote David Sirota, he boils it down into one nice, neat little sentence. Congress actually created an incentive, or at least no disincentive, for the following scenario. Banks can lose your information, then use their own negligence as an opportunity to bleed you dry with higher interest rates, late fees, and all the other horrible things that are heaped upon citizens as they accrue debt. Isn't that sweet? Isn't that just so sweet? Joe Biden, why did you vote for that? Debbie Stabenow, Jim Jeffords. Yeah, there's a whole list. It's just why? Stephen in Yahats, Oregon, a member of the Democratic Union of Cascadia, sent me a note. He said, Senator Smith is not a moderate. Apparently, I had referred to the Republican senator from Oregon, Gordon Smith, as a moderate. I'm surprised that I would have just used that word so easily. Perhaps I did. I don't have a specific recollection of it, but at the very least, I implied it. And Steve felt the need to set me straight, and I appreciate this. He said, our illustrious junior senator, Gordon Smith, is not a moderate. He's up for re-election to a third term in 2006 and really needs to look like one. This apparently is why Senator Smith is now taking some moderate positions. He says every now and then he will take some sort of moderate position, but in every case, he has supported Bush when it really matters. Senator Smith, like Mr. Bush, was born to a wealthy family. He supports torture, outsourcing, tax cuts, the Iraq War, etc. He represents the most foul of Republican values without moderation. And Steve says, warm regards. It's been 65 to 70 every day here in Oregon. I'm jealous. Nice sunny day here in Vermont right now. Here, another one. Scott in Michigan contacted his senator, Senator Debbie Stabenow, said, what's the deal here with this bankruptcy bill vote? He said, I called her office just now and told the staffer that I'd called to urge the senator not to vote for this bill and asked him why she voted for it. He said, this has to be one of the all-time great answers to give to a constituent. He said he didn't know why. So I then asked him if she was going to issue a statement or explanation of some sort for her vote. He said he didn't know either, if that either. But he asked for my contact information and said if a statement was issued, it would be sent to me. Isn't that generous? My local paper runs a weekly How Your Lawmakers Voted column, he says, and I see that the Senate voted on amendments to Senate 256 as well. Both my senators voted for the credit card fees amendment that failed, which sought to stop accrual of late fees for consumers who entered credit counseling and adopted debt payment plan. In other words, Stabenow and Carl Levin, I think, is the other senator from Michigan. They also both voted for the Disabled Veterans Amendment, which passed 99-0, which grants protections to veterans. On the Conflict of Interest Amendment, which sought to retain a ban, which failed, now in law, to keep investment banks from both underwriting a company's securities and then getting involved in bankruptcy proceedings the company goes under, Senator Levin voted to keep the ban, and Senator Stabenow voted to end the ban. At least they did something that helped disabled veterans. But beyond that, you know, what's the deal here? This from Ward in Kashima, Japan. He says, I'm listening to you now about talk about China via radiopower.org. This radiopower.org rebroadcasts our program, I think, about every 3 hours, every other segment, more or less, throughout the day. And several times throughout the day, you can hear the program rebroadcast, the most recent program. And he says, this is a subject that hits close to home. My home is in Japan. He says, I live under the flight path of Mitsubishi F-15s, which operate out of Hayakuri. JASDF base, that would be the Japanese defense fund, force, the equivalent of the Japanese Air Force. He says, I'm a private pilot, so I keep an eye out for such things. They fly over my house on the way back from target practice offshore. They've been busy lately. He says, the issue is complex, of course, but it seems to me the posture taking place right now is all largely related to oil depletion. And I'm telling you, there is actually a larger issue here, Ward, and I'll read the rest of Ward's letter in just a moment, but there really is a larger issue. The big issue, the 7-pound, 100-pound gorilla in the room that nobody's talking about, is the fact the world is running low on oil. Oil depletion. In fact, those of you who are scholars of World War II history will remember that one of the reasons why Japan attacked us at Pearl Harbor was because we blockaded the Straits of Malacca. The straits between Borneo and Indonesia, as I recall, I've sailed through there. I'm pretty sure that that's exactly where they are. Somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure, in our chat room. In any case, that we had barricaded the Straits of Malacca, which was the line through which oil from the Middle East was coming into Japan. And Japan, without that oil from the Middle East, was without energy. The Royal Empire couldn't fight its war against China and so on, you know, and so Japan attacked us at Pearl Harbor because we blockaded the Straits of Malacca. And there are some who suggest that Roosevelt, when he intentionally decided to erect that blockade, did so knowing that China would react violently and thus draw us into the war because he wanted to draw us into the war. And he knew that once Japan had attacked us, Japan had a mutual defense and aggression pact with Germany. Therefore, Germany would be required to declare war against us. And that's exactly what happened. Japan attacked us. We then attacked Japan. We then declared war on Japan. And Japan said to Germany, hey, the United States has declared war on us. Therefore, you have to declare war on them. Germany said, right on. And they declared war on us. As I was not alive at the time, but that's my recollection of the history. So in any case, we cut off the oil supply to Japan and boom, suddenly we're in World War II. And there are a lot of folks suggesting that we will be in World War III, that we may already be in World War III as a result of our behavior in Iraq because of oil, that we're doing the same thing Japan did, that we are out there using military force to protect our oil supplies. And it's a strong case, and I agree with it. But I think it goes beyond that even. And where it goes beyond that is the 25 years of voodoo economics, of trickle-down economics, of supply-side economics, of Reaganomics, of Bushonomics, of, to some extent, Clintonomics, at least with regard to international trade, the 25 years of this have left the United States broke. We are no longer the richest nation in the world. We are no longer the most powerful nation in the world. We may have a lot of nuclear weapons, but we can't even fight a war in two half-baked, tiny, defenseless countries. Iraq didn't even have an air force. They had been, you know, suffering under sanctions for years and years and years. Afghanistan was basically living in the Stone Age, and just attacking these two countries, we have stretched ourselves beyond our own limits. We are not the militarily strong nation that we thought we were, and we are broke. We have gone from being the nation that under Jimmy Carter held the most of the world's debt, that is, most of the world owed us money, through Reagan borrowing money like crazy, Bush Senior boy borrowing money like crazy, Clinton borrowing money for much of his administration, although he did turn that around, and Bush Junior now, Shrub, borrowing money like there's no tomorrow, to the point where we are now the world's largest debtor. We are broke. And I think that that's actually the largest issue. 20 minutes after the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls. But you're going to have to serve somebody.
How about democracy? That's my starting point here. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Back to, by the way, one of the folks in our chat room corrected me. Malaysia and Sumatra are the countries that border the Straits of Malacca. When we sailed through there, Louise and I, back 15, 20 years ago, we were on a small boat, and along with a fellow by the name of Will Crinan. He was a medical doctor from Canada. And, in fact, an interview with him appears in my book, ADD, A Different Perception. He had just finished doing a gig as the doctor, the Red Cross doctor for Pol Pot, the dictator of and mass murderer of Cambodia. And he had some fascinating stories to tell. One of the most interesting that I thought was that Pol Pot had done the same thing that Maximilian Robespierre did during the latter years of the French Revolution when they were into the terrors, and that the Catholic Church did, the Holy Roman Empire as it morphed into the Catholic Church, did in the, 2300 AD, 2300 range, where whenever it was that they redid the calendars, they reset the year. They set the year to zero. The French did the same thing during the French Revolution. It is now officially year number one. But you think about, you know, who controls history. The people who control history are ultimately the people who control the calendar to a large extent. And Pol Pot, the reason Pol Pot had, according to Will Crinan, this is what Will told us, the reason Pol Pot had ordered the murder of anybody who wore eyeglasses was because that meant they were literate. And he didn't want anybody literate left. Anybody over the age of 40, dead. He didn't want there to be any institutional memory. He wanted to create a whole brand new nation of people who had no past. So they would remember history as he told it to them. He was going to rewrite history and create a Cambodia that only knew him and his worldview. And he had to kill 2 million people to do it. And he did. And Will told us the story about all this, and it's fascinating when you look at how the cons are so aggressively rewriting history now. There are all these books and all these right-wing websites running around talking about how, for example, suggesting that the founding fathers were all Bible-thumping Christians, when in fact the most important of the founders were very far from that. Some of them were openly skeptical. Most of them were deists. Some of them were outright atheists. Some were Christians. But clearly, the word God does not appear anywhere in the Constitution. They wanted to have a godless government, for example. Or, for example, if you go to whitehouse.gov and read the biography of James Madison, the fourth president of the United States. President of the United States, now keep in mind, the Republican Party itself came into being in Jackson, Michigan, in, as I recall, 1856. I might be wrong on the year. It might have been 1854 or something like that. In any case, it was right around then, right around the 1850s. Madison was president, became president in 1809, the election of 1808. He is listed on whitehouse.gov as a Republican. This, 30 years before the Republican Party even existed. And the president that followed him, James Monroe, he's listed as a Republican. These guys were members of the party that we today call the Democratic Party. They were called then the Democratic Republicans. And in the 1830s, they dropped the word Republican from their name. But they were always the Democratic Republicans. And any decent historian refers to them as the Democratic Republicans. But no, the WhiteHouse.gov site refers to them as Republicans, as if the Republicans have been running this country ever since Thomas Jefferson. In fact, they refer to Jefferson as a Republican. Go figure. Anyhow, rewriting history. Just right after this break, I want to finish up with this email from Ward, because he got an interesting comment here on China and oil. And then I have a bit of news for you about voting machines. I think you will find both startling and chilling, including an update from Ms. Clinton herself. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And the bumper music croaked. Welcome back, my friends. It's Tom Hartman here with you. And you're in the listening to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. And with a bumper music dysfunction, it's we need more Viagra for your brain here for this thing. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. So glad to have you with us. Just to wrap up Ward's comments from Japan, he's Taiwan, of course, he says, has been part of China, more recently Japan, but it's only part of a bigger puzzle, in my opinion. Eventually, maybe the China, Japan, and all of Korea, perhaps other Asian nations, form an economic union of sorts. That would be quite an historical irony, considering the imperial ruse Japan used in the early 20th century for the Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere. We live in interesting times. I agree. And I think that that's a very significant possibility, Ward. Now, this some news to curl your hair. A couple of bits of you know, fascinating factoids, as they say. The first is from a blog, and from mydd.com, mydd.com. And so, you know, it's an opinion as opposed to here's the solid news. But I find the information from this blog to be very often very credible. And so I'm going to toss this out right now, not having triple and quadruple checked it. And let's just see where it goes. Yeah, those caveats in place. And Jolly Buddha writes that the LA Daily News has already reported on this story. The California Secretary of State's office announced Wednesday that it will immediately investigate, why City Clerk Frank Martinez changed the software on the voting system used in Los Angeles mayoral primary without state approval. One of several steps he took that slowed the count and raised questions about the integrity of the process. Martinez said, it goes on, he ordered a change in computer code in the scanner that reads IncaVote ballots. This would be the kind of things where you get it's like an SAT test where you get the ballot and you fill in the little circles, you know, and with ink or pencil or whatever. And then you run the paper through a scanner and it reads which circles you marked or which, you know, between the lines sort of things. The brand name IncaVote. That he changed the computer code in the scanner that reads the IncaVote ballots in order to reduce uncertainty in what was anticipated to be an extremely close race. Now, we know that a number of states, after Florida, for example, Ohio in particular, Nebraska the same, many states, after they put in electronic voting machines, then passed laws saying that you couldn't do an audit unless the vote was really, really close. In Ohio, I believe that the automatic audit provision, well, I'm not sure right off the top of my head the exact number, so I shouldn't toss it out. My recollection is it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 0.25%, but whatever it is, it's fairly low. And so if you've got a razor thin margin, then you get an automatic recount. But without that, hey, that's life. And so this guy says, okay, we're going to have a close vote, so let's make sure it's not a close vote. Let's reduce the uncertainty, which means that there wouldn't be an audit, presumably. Now, I'm proposing or supposing here. I'm guessing. We'll see where this goes. It adds, on election night, he ordered workers to hand sort the ballots and re-ink thousands of votes that might be too faint to scan. He had election workers going through and modifying ballots. But the change was made without getting the required approval of state officials, said Secretary of State's office spokeswoman Carol Daniels Mead. She said, I'm really surprised to hear this. We were not alerted to any changes. We did not approve any changes. It's fascinating. Fascinating. Martinez, who has been criticized for not telling the candidates or allowing independent observers to watch the overwriting of the ballots. Oh, that's interesting. They modified the ballots and didn't let anybody watch. said his office tested the new IncaVote system about a month before the March 8th primary and required a change in computer software telling the system to proceed to the next ballot. He thought the change was so minor it did not need to be approved by the state. Fascinating. I'm telling you, electronic voting, where you can modify, I mean, it's like saying, okay, let's make sure that all our lives depend on the quality, veracity, and accuracy of the information that comes out of our Windows PCs, because most of these are Windows PCs. I don't know about this particular system. The Diebolts, for example, are. And at the same time, I get an email from Hillary. This from, not personally, it's from friendsofhillary.com, which is, I would say, obviously her let's run her for president in 2008 bunch, but that's, you know, she has a 2006 election to take care of first. She says, dear friends, thank you so much for signing up as a citizen co-sponsor of the Count Every Vote Act of 2005. With your support and that of more than 116,000 people all across the country, we have made substantial progress in recent weeks. Now, what we're talking about here is a law that Hillary proposed, along with a few other people. I mean, she's going to get out in front of this. She's figured out this is a hot issue. Well, that's what politicians do. You can't criticize her for it. In fact, let's hope she's successful. But they've proposed this law, this Count Every Vote Act, which would make it a crime. Crime, with a capital C, a crime, a felony, for somebody like Ken Blackwell or Catherine Harris to do the things that Ken Blackwell in Ohio and Catherine Harris in Florida did. It would make it a crime for them to supervise the electoral process and be in charge of a political campaign. It would require electronic voting machines to produce voter-verified paper ballots. It would require that there be automatic spot checks and random evaluations of machines. It would build in all sorts of security provisions. Now, I'm still a fan of good old-fashioned paper. I don't think we should have voting machines at all. I think that we should do like most of the rest of the world does. You know, most of Canada just got rid of their voting machines and said, sorry, guys, we're going back to paper. People say, but it takes 3 or 4 days to count all that paper. So what? The election's held in November. People take office in January. Why was that? So there'd be time to count the paper. But what about in those other countries where they count paper? Don't people want to know who won? Well, of course people want to know who won, and for that reason they have exit polls. When I lived in Germany, the exit polls reported about an hour after the polls closed. And ever since the 1950s, when they first started doing this after World War II, the exit polls have never been more than a tenth of a percent off in Germany. They're accurate. One of the reasons why I believe they were accurate in the United States in 2000, 2002, and 2004, 3 years, the first 3 years in the history of the country, when the exit polls showed the Republicans losing, but the electronic voting machines showed the Republicans winning. But that's how they do it in Canada. That's how they do it in Germany. That's how they do it in France. That's how they do it in Italy. That's how they do it in other countries. They have exit polls. It worked in the Ukraine. You know, the margin that they tried to steal the election in Ukraine, the margin of what the voting machines said the party guy, the Putin-affiliated guy, won by, versus the 3 points that the exit polls showed that he lost by, was nearly identical to the margin in the United States between the difference between the output from the electronic voting machines and the exit polls in the United States. The exit polls all showed John Kerry winning by about 3%. Same as in the Ukraine. But I digress. By the way, although I thought I was particularly interested when Matofsky and Edison, the exit polling company, released their raw data and they came up with their shy Republican theory that the data was analyzed by Josh Middledorf and Steve Freeman and a few other professional, you know, people who professors at universities who analyze statistics for a living and teach it. And they said, first of all, the actual data shows that the Republicans are not at all shy. In the Republican strongholds, 56% of the Republicans were willing to participate. In the Democratic strongholds, 53% of the Democrats were willing to participate. So if anything, they were shy Democrats, number one. And number two, in those states where the vote was counted by hand on paper ballot, there's not a lot of them, but there are still a few. In those states where the vote was counted by hand on paper ballot, the exit polls were accurate. And in those states where the vote was counted by voting machine with no paper ballot and no trace ability, the vote was the weirdest in favor of Bush. So anyhow, Hillary Clinton, and I suspect it's because she plans to run for president in 2008, and she knows if these voting machines are still in place in 2008, even if she wins, she'll lose. She has proposed legislation to clean this sewer up. And she said she's got 116,000 people have signed the petition. She said, even with all the energy and action you've helped generate, we still have an uphill climb. It doesn't appear that the administration and the Republican leadership are as concerned as we are about ensuring people's right to vote. Gee, what a surprise. Actually, it is, you know. I mean, they must really believe, like Stalin believed, that they could hold on to power forever. Why else would they embrace a corruptible system? You tell me. I can figure out no possible reason other than that they are using it and that they believe that they can hold on to power forever. Hillary says, isn't it ironic that at the same time the White House is welcoming elections in other parts of the world, we still have to fight to make democracy real here at home? But fight we will! And in the weeks since the Count Every Vote Act of 2005 was introduced by Senators Boxer, Lautenberg, Kerry, and myself, your personal commitment has helped build our momentum. She points out Senator Pat Leahy, Democrat from Vermont, ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has joined us as a co-sponsor. The New York Times on February 22nd described the Count Every Vote Act as, quote, the gold standard for election reform, end quote, although I guarantee you it wasn't on the front page. Among the provisions of the bill that singled out as worthy of note were paper records for every vote cast, restrictions on political activity by voting machine manufacturers, no more president of Diebold, good old Wally O'Dell, saying that he's going to deliver the state of Ohio for George Bush, as he did a year ago, as he said. Minimum standards for the number of voting machines per precinct. No more Ken Blackwell-isms. Black neighborhood that traditionally votes Democratic, they can have half as many machines as normal. Nice Republican suburb in the white area, vote mostly for Bush. We'll give them extra voting machines. Get them out in 20 minutes. As the Times stated, Hillary notes, our bill would also prevent states from using, quote, onerous identification requirements to turn away eligible voters, end quote. Yeah, I can just hear the cons now. Oh, they're going to use this thing so that illegal aliens can vote. Like illegal aliens care. Of all the hysterical nonsense, I mean, that raises to the level of, in any case. She says, most important of all, we need to get active. We now have more than 116,000 citizen co-sponsors from every state in the union, and we continue to get more every day. She says, as I look at the record of this Republican Congress, I know that our task is not going to be easy, but I also know that together we can make a difference. You know, blah de blah de blah. And, of course, down at the bottom, contribute to Friends of Hillary today. Gee, what a surprise. Anyhow, if you want to check it out, friendsofhillary.com is the website. And no, I'm not endorsing her for president. I'm not endorsing her either. I'm waiting. But I think this is good. I think this is really good. 1-866-889-8894 telephone number. Jeff in Denver. Hey Jeff, thanks for waiting for me to finish that rant there. What's on your mind today?
Election reform. Yeah, being on the front lines here in Colorado. Several things. One is we actually have a bill that's going to be appearing before the Senate very soon here.
Jeff, can you speak up a little bit?
Yeah, we're going to have a new bill that will require paper ballots here in Colorado before the Senate next week. It's Senate Bill 198 for Colorado residents. Please take a look at it.
This is the Colorado Senate.
Yes.
Great. Great. Is it being sponsored by both Republicans and Democrats, or is it following this same bizarre pattern that in the United States Congress, only Democrats are interested in voting machines that are clean and the Republicans are opposed to them?
It was created by two Democrats and one Republican.
That's great. That's great.
But one key thing people need to remember in election reform is that a paper ballot does nothing if it's not counted to begin with. It's the thing of it's only good for a recount. And the basic thing is, why don't we have a voting system that works very much like double-entry bookkeeping, where we count it twice and compare the totals?
There you go. And, in fact, what I've been suggesting all along is that and one way to do that would be that the voting machines make one count, and then you run the ballot through a scanner, and that's a second count.
Yes. Well, we have a website now called we're proposing something called Self-Auditing Verified Voting, SAVV. We at savvy.org, we describe what this is, but it works on that system.
SAVVY.org?
No, SAVV.
Oh, just SAVV. Okay. You should have tossed the Y in just to make it. Anyhow, so no Y. SAVV.org. Jeff in Oregon has got, in Denver, Colorado, has this thing going, and this is great. Jeff, congratulations. Good on you.
Thanks.
Keep it
Take
up.
Care.
Keep up the great work. 10 minutes before the hour. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. With the continuing erosion of the middle class,
fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
But come ye back when summer's in the meadow, when all the valley's hushed and white with snow.
Yes, and happy St. Patty's Day. Happy St. Patty's weekend. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour. Helping Halliburton hide. Have you caught this one? This has been kind of sliding under the radar. It's the sort of thing that, for some reason could be, hey, it's just part of the old boys club, doesn't make it into the media. Certainly the Whitewater land deal. Susan McDougal went to prison over this thing for refusing to make up lies. I mean, literally, that's she said, hey, I'm telling you the truth. And they said, that's not what we want to hear. Well, Ken Starr tossed her in jail for a deal that involved Bill Clinton losing $30,000 on a land development in Arkansas 30 years before he became president. Well, but when the vice president supervises a no-bid contract for his company, which is still paying him a couple $100,000 a year, and in which he owns millions of dollars worth of stock, which becomes more valuable every year that the war in Iraq continues, nobody raises an eyebrow about that, and it doesn't get discussed in the mainstream press. And now we discover that Halliburton is scrubbing its own is scrubbing the government reports about its own activities. In 2004, this is from thinkprogress.org, in 2004, the UN International Advisory and Monitoring Board, the IAMB, the international group that oversees the use of Iraqi money on Iraqi reconstruction, wanted to know more about Halliburton. Specifically, they wanted to conduct an audit of Halliburton subsidiary KB&R, Kellogg Brown and Root. This $1.6 billion Iraqi contract, all of the money coming right from Iraqi coffers, not from our taxpayer dollars, but from Iraq. After much foot-dragging, the White House finally complied, sending the IAMB heavily redacted versions of audits the Pentagon's Defense Contract Audit Agency had conducted into Halliburton's use of the money. Turns out all this blacking out? Well, I'll just read it straight here. Blacked out of the redacted report was the fact that Halliburton may have bilked the U.S. military out of about $100 million. Also blacked out were, well, they've got to pay Dick Cheney's salary every month, and they are. Also blacked out were statements critical of KBR, like, quote, KBR was unable to reconcile the proposed cuts to its accounting records, and KBR did not always provide accurate information. These were blacked out. Now, who blacked them out? This is where it gets really interesting. Henry Waxman's office, Congressman Henry Waxman's office, looks at this thing and goes, why did somebody black this out? It turns out they discovered that the White House gave Halliburton a copy of the negative audit and let the company black stuff out before it got sent to the United Nations. A letter from KBR dated 9/28/04 to the Army Corps of Engineers states, and here's Kellogg Brown wrote, this is Halliburton saying, we did this, by the way. A letter from KBR to the Army Corps of Engineers says, quote, we have redacted, that is, you know, covered up with black ink, the statements of DCAA that we believe are factually incorrect or misleading and could be used by a competitor to damage KBR's ability to win and negotiate new work, end quote. Yes, it a competitor. How about we the people, Mr. Cheney? This is outrageous. It'll be interesting to see if the Bush family's good friend Bob Schieffer reports on it tonight, or if Brian Williams, the guy who says that his duty is to listen to Rush Limbaugh every day, reports on it tonight, or if Mr. Peter Jennings reports on it tonight. It'll be interesting to see. I'm Tom Hartman. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Same time, same place.